The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, April 5th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is another of our famous so-called vacation shows. Today, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame, Patrick J. Denneen, Why Liberalism Failed. It's really actually more about has liberalism failed because it has succeeded. And just to spoiler alert, by liberalism, we're talking about classic liberalism. Yes, I know, confusing, ladies and gentlemen. But a fascinating look at the current order, which I know you'll enjoy. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are on day four of our vacation. As you know, we follow the Department of Education school calendar for vacations because I don't want to pay for childcare during that time. I don't know what to tell you. That's just the way we roll here. I am still recovering from the pneumonia I had a couple of weeks ago. Hopefully, I'm actually recording this a couple of days before now, so hopefully I'm fully recovered by now. But I am probably hanging out with my kids, telling them, please, please, go outside. Do something. Do something. Well, I told you you could have done that musication camp, but you didn't want to. So now go out and do something. No. No watching TV. I'm just giving you like little snippets of what it's probably like in my house right now. Well, if you don't behave yourself, I'll take you all to Worcester. What do you think about that? You want to go to Worcester? Who wants to go to Worcester? That's what I thought. So do something. Folks, yes, it's one of our famous vacation shows. Tomorrow on the program, you do not want to miss Julianne Wilson. She is an associate professor at Allegheny College, I believe it is. She's written it's a really interesting interview. She's written a textbook on neoliberalism for her students and why she wrote it. We talk about, it's interesting. You should check that out. Today we have Patrick Denneen. This is probably one of the more philosophical, right? Would you say, Matt?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I mean, it's
theoretical.
It's not too theoretical, yeah, but it's a little bit more theoretical than we normally get around these parts, but why not?
It's an unorthodox guest.
It is an unorthodox guest. Yes, you're absolutely right about that. Of course, Brian Alexander the other day, that was completely not theoretical. That was just basically straight reporting. Interesting, but very straight reporting. So that's the way we roll here, folks. And of course, like we've had over the past couple of days, Matt has put together a Matt pick from the deep archives, or the semi-deep archives, of the Majority Report vaults. As you know, maybe you don't, this show started as a radio show on Air America Radio, co-hosted by Janine Garofalo and myself. So we've got some pretty big names from back in the day. Matt drops them in. Oh, I'm sorry, what? You're not a member? Oh, well then you won't be able to listen. That's too bad. If only there was a way for you to be able to become a member. Oh, that's right. Join themajorityreport.com. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. By becoming a member and supporting the free show, you are becoming a member and supporting the free show. And as a way of saying thank you, we offer you extra content virtually every single day. So join themajorityreport.com. Check it out. Quick break. When we come back, an interview I did with Patrick Denneen on Why Liberalism Failed. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Patrick Denine. He is a professor of political scientist at the University of Notre Dame, and the book is Why Liberalism Failed. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, the problem is not that liberalism failed, it's that it has succeeded, I think, is the argument you're making. Let's start, though, first, so that people are not confused. Define for us, and this is actually, I guess, a big part of the book, what liberalism is in the context of what you're talking about.
Yeah, sure. And actually, I'm flattered. It seems you actually read the book. Most people think I'm simply arguing that liberalism failed, but I'm arguing that it's if we see a kind of failure of our political system, it's because in some ways it's working. That's the irony. What I mean by liberalism is really the kind of the political operating system of much of the Western world, certainly the United States. Probably the story begins some 500 years ago with the effort to re-found rethink the basis of politics, and really to base politics in ways that we're familiar with on the theory of individual rights and on that legitimate government is on the basis of the consent of the governed. But what I really emphasize in the book is that it's not merely a political philosophy. It's actually, you could say, a kind of comprehensive system that reshapes the world in the kind of image and likeness of that understanding of the human person as the individual self-making self, the kind of self-creating individual that's not defined by birth, by place, by any kind of tradition or cultural inheritance. And so on the one hand, that's the source and ground of our liberty, but on the other hand, it has become in some ways a kind of solvent that's dissolved all of the kind of bonds that in some ways define a society. And so the irony is that as liberalism has become more fully itself over time, it's also becoming less manageable as a political and social system, in as much as people in some ways now are almost like atomistically increasingly separated from each other, at odds with each other. And so the very kind of condition of our liberty also leads to a condition of increasing atomization, and at the same time a kind of a loss of a kind of sense of power over the system that now purports to make us free.
All right, and so let's talk about that point. I mean, it's almost as if, and we should say, in the context of the way I think people colloquially understand politics in today's era, the left and the right, or the so-called liberal and conservative, a different liberal, we should say, and conservative, are sort of like Isaac and Ishmael in a way, and this idea of liberalism is the father, and they have sort of split off, but operate within the same construct. So let's talk about that moment where this from whence this idea came, this sort of that wiped off the veneer of those connections. And then let's talk about how it sort of it split. Isaac and Ishmael, I guess, went their separate ways.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a great story. It's the story of our past and where we are today. I think the story begins, we could say, in a kind of circumstance that we can all, I think, intuitively understand, that in a kind of an older society, think of an aristocratic society, who you are, your identity, and what you will be is defined by who you're born, where you're born to. The way I usually illustrate this to students is think of the kind of classic WASP kind of names like Smith or Weaver or Taylor or Cooper, and all of those things were one's professions. They weren't just random last names. It meant that's what you were going to be doing when you grew up, and that was the profession that you inherited. It wasn't just a name. It was who you were going to be. or more easily identified at a place that I teach at the University of Notre Dame, if your name is O'Shaughnessy or O'Leary or McWilliams, those names indicated who you were from, so that you were a child of Leary or the son of John Johnson or something like that. And you could say liberalism, in addition to being a political program, was the effort to liberate people from any kind of defined, inherited form of identity. And we live in a world today in which we assume, indeed it's kind of the ground condition of what we think of as our liberty, that we assume that we define who we are, and that we define what we will do, where we will live, who we will be with. But the kind of the nub of the issue is that in order to create the conditions that liberate us from not only, we could say, oppressive political structures, but even what come to be seen as unchosen forms of ascribed identity, like one's profession, one's familial ties that can define one, and so forth. There's a kind of need to remake society so that we become ever more and more individuated, more and more freed from those kinds of defining bonds. To the point that now, I think you see a lot of the social science data suggests that we are the most disconnected and atomized people ever to exist, since those things have been measured in extraordinary forms of declines of rates of formation of family, marriage, reproduction, fertility, so forth, and as well as, you could say, the kinds of forms of associational life, joining voluntary associations, political parties, churches, even patriotism is kind of in the decline as you move toward younger generations, from older generation to younger generation. So the ground condition of our liberty makes it more and more difficult for us to see that we have anything in common, that there is any such thing as a common good, other than the securing of our individual self-making selves. But there's a question of whether you can base a society on that aim or ambition.
All right, well, we're getting ahead of ourselves again, where we're looking at the failure. I want to stay sort of like let's go to the founding of this country. I mean, as these ideas of liberalism across the Atlantic, and we obviously these are ideas that come out of Hobbes, and Locke carries it in slightly different ways, but let's land on the United States and track where this notion of an individual with the right to sort of have control over their own destiny, it will veer off into two different ways into what we consider the left and the right, I guess, today. Take us to that moment.
Well, sure. Of course, the founding of the country, so we think about the Constitution and the debates over the Constitution during the period of ratification, of course, preceding that, the Declaration of Independence. These were, particularly the Declaration, you can see as really an articulation, a rearticulation, a rephrasing of the philosophy of John Locke, which argues that we are by nature free and equal individuals. That is our natural condition. It's not necessarily how you find us in the state of society, but it's posited that this is the condition that that we would find ourselves in if you could strip off all of the kind of sedimentation of culture and tradition and inheritance and all this sorts of kinds of identity that seemed so thick on the ground at the time that the Declaration, that John Locke was writing. And if you stripped all those things away, what we would find is that we were in our kind of natural state, that we are free and equal individuals, and that any kind of bond or relationship or any obligation that we would take on can only be seen as legitimate if it's through our own individual choice. So in other words, the only legitimate forms of connection to other people have to be freely chosen in a kind of condition in which There's no sort of external pressure. There's no kind of tilting of the scale in how we make our decision one way or the other. No pressure from the parents who you should marry, for example. Marriage really has to be the choice of the individual and so forth. So that society has to be in many ways remade on the ideal of this liberated individual. And at the time of the founding, the effort of the founding fathers was to create a, in the first instance, a system of government that would be based upon the consent of the governed, but that would also create a nation, ultimately, that would allow for the greatest expression and pursuit of these individual ends, these rights that are inherent in the individual. And so in early in the writing of the justification of the Constitution, Madison, for example, writes that the greatest source of division within political society is the kind of inequality that you often see when people are able to accrue differences of property, differences in their status of life, but that the object of government is to preserve these differences, is to preserve, in fact, the faculties from which these differences arise, so that the end or purpose of government is to preserve private things, in a sense, the things that differentiate us from each other, that the purpose and object of government is to secure our individual pursuit of our own goods. And this is a kind of real transformation of the idea of what government is for, in one sense, that government, you know, by a more classical understanding, would have been understood as in some ways the effort to forge some sense of a common good. So you see, in even at the time of the founding, an idea that this is the purpose and end of government is the securing of private ends and private goods, particularly relating to kind of external forms of property.
Right.
And this is what we think of today as classical liberalism, right, or in different forms, libertarianism, or what we call today conservatism. But we need to understand that this is liberalism, even though we tend to call it conservatism today.
And we should say, okay, that pursuit of that protection of private property. I mean, the irony is, of course, that you can't escape the social contract you're born into, right? I mean, you have these sort of Lockean ideas of I'm not going. The individual can't, you know, should not be identified by those, I guess, sort of preordained relationships. But in the context of a country, right? You show up and you're a citizen of that country.
Yeah, this is one of the real interesting little hitches in the sort of social contract thinking. Locke and we could say our founding fathers think of this as well, which is that if you're born into a kind of a society that's already established, you basically kind of sign on to it implicitly. Locke calls it tacit consent. You've given your silent consent to the form of government. But it's interesting that for example, Thomas Jefferson, the year before he writes the Declaration of Independence, writes a pamphlet leading up to the Revolution in which he says that one of the fundamental rights of British citizens is the right to exit, is the right to leave, which Americans exercised in leaving Britain. And so this, you could say that kind of always there is the potential right of exit. And I think this is one of the core features of, we could say, liberal, both political, but also sort of, we could say, social and even personal thinking about ourselves, which is that one is only truly free, not only when you can choose the situation you're in, even if it's tacit, even if it's just a silent kind of consent, but that one also preserves the right to exit whatever situation one has entered into. And I think, again, you can see how this becomes transformative, for example, when we think about marriage, for example, and the idea that you can enter into marriage as an individual choice, but you can also exit marriage fairly easily. And in a liberal society, that exit has to be as easy as possible, because otherwise it would be a kind of, you'd be forced to live with a choice that you may come to regret after some period of time.
So, okay, so if the birth, if you will, at least in the context of this country, of what we identify as conservatism, and I think people can, you know, it's a hallmark of the libertarian strain of property rights as the fundamental bedrock, I guess, of the individual. What is the other side of that coin for progressives, let's call that, for the, so that we don't get into, I mean, I think some progressives might take issue with that, but so they don't want to get into the confusion of using liberalism in the two different ways. What's the flip side of that coin?
Right. So in the first instance, so what we think of as classical liberalism, or these terms get confusing, but classical liberalism, or what we typically today call conservatism, it's one of its basically its main means of securing this idea of individual liberty is, in the first instance, a state that is in a sense a limited state, a limited government, that its only job is to secure the rights of individuals as defined in particular as the kind of the rights especially concerning property, individual liberty, rights of freedom of speech, rights of movement, and so forth. So a kind of minimal set of rights that the state comes into existence to secure, but which allows for, let's say, the kind of expansion of a market system, and the state supports the expansion of a market system. And the and one of the main means by which we achieve a kind of our individual liberty is through the kinds of choices we make in a market. And so one of the main means of the achievement of this individual liberty is through a market society. And progressivism really comes as a result in some ways of the very success of this classical liberal project, which was to, in many ways, to create a much more individuated society, but also, of course, as we know, created a society of pretty significant economic inequality, as Locke predicted would be the case. People who were better at accumulating property would accumulate more, and people who were less able or less well situated to do so accumulated less. And this, of course, led to the question of how could people be truly equal and free if there was such substantial difference in the attainment of property. And progressivism arises not as a rejection of the liberal political order, but really as an effort to say, in order for it to be legitimate, people have to be, in some senses, given a relatively equal starting point, or at least the opportunity to have an equal starting point in the race of life. So it's not full-blown socialism. I know there's discussions of whether the left is really moving towards socialism today, but progressivism began as the effort to say, we're going to get everybody so they can have a kind of equal starting point on the race of life. And so that people can still pursue lives of equal and individual self-fashioning, but they do so with, in some instances, with the assistance of an enlarged government, a government that's now not merely going to secure kind of the negative rights that we think of, or those kind of basic rights of free speech and property and so forth, but now is going to think about the kinds of rights that you hear progressives talking about today, healthcare and progressive tax and education, and you know all those various sorts of investments into the flourishing of individuals in a market society. So it's not the overturning of a market society; it's rather the kind of effort to lend some degree of equality into the market society. But this ends up, in some ways, being the kind of flip side of the coin, because really, what our politics becomes is a debate over means, which is to say, what is the best means of securing the equal, free individual? Is it really a kind of a market system, ultimately, with a minimal state? Or is it a state that corrects but nevertheless exists fairly comfortably alongside a market system? And so the kind of ferocious debates that we have today end up really being debates over means, in which the end is the same. And for this reason, as I argue in the book, what we see, even though we have these titanic battles in our politics today, what we tend to see is the ongoing growth of both the state and the market, and the increase of individualism as a consequence of both of those things.
The ends, and ultimately, you have an issue with the ends. I mean, I don't want to get ahead of myself on this level, but I mean, there's arguments as to, I guess, whether or not there is, you know, there's arguments, I guess, within that, or sub arguments as to whether or not is the market really free? Is it really, you know, is there a difference even between the idea of the progressives who want to make sure that people are given the same opportunity in the markets, and therefore want the state to intervene, and on the right, where the state has intervened, right, by simply saying, like, property rights are the primary rights. I mean, that's also, you know, that's not a foregone conclusion, right? That was a novel concept, or at least a new or an introduced concept.
Yeah, sure. In fact, you know, part of what I revisit some older arguments in the book that talk all about, in some ways, the creation of a market society. I mean, I think we do have this kind of this sort of libertarian, I would regard it as a myth, a kind of mythos that's propounded by libertarians that suggests our kind of natural condition is to exist in a kind of perfect free market environment. And it's only with the creation of the state that this perfect, what's called sometimes spontaneous order, a kind of spontaneous market system, would just pop up if there were no government, if people could just run their own affairs. But in fact, the kind of history if you look back at the kind of economic history, what you see is actually a pretty extensive investment by the state in the creation of the modern market system. And in some cases, violent efforts by the state to reorder society so that you would have you would really propound and indeed begin to sort of legitimize the idea that all property was essentially private, or any property that was considered to be not owned by the government was private property. Whereas there was, in more medieval England, there were lots of sort of spaces that were just considered common spaces. So there's a kind of a transformation, precisely as you described, that creates a market system. And so this is correct, there's a deep linkage ultimately between the modern state and the modern market. And again, what we tend to debate about is how extensive should the market be relative to the state, and how extensive should the state be relative to the market. But in fact, both tend to wax, both tend to grow in conjunction with the rise of, and indeed the realization of, this individual, this creature that's supposed to exist by nature, but can in fact only exist through extensive artifice, through extensive creation, both of the state and the market.
I don't want to get too bogged down in this, but is it really, at the end of the day, an argument about that relationship between the state and the market in terms of, like, how much state and how much market? Or is it what element of the market is going to get the benefit of the state? I mean,
that's certainly a part of our everyday politics, and I don't want to minimize how important those debates are, but from the macro view, and really what I'm trying to argue in the book, is that the debate really tends to be over which system of depersonalized relationship are we going to prefer and put into the kind of primary position. And this is the real, you could say, one of the major kind of desiderata of the liberal order, is to transform every form of what might have been a form of personal obligation entailing certain duties and responsibilities that you would owe to a specific person, and to transform those into depersonalized relationships. Because when you have a personal obligation to someone, you don't feel free, right? You feel like you're obligated to do something for someone. When it's depersonalized, I'm not obligated to that particular person. I'll give you a really quick example of what I mean by this. I often use the Amish as a kind of example of kind of an opposite system. So I'm not suggesting we should all become Amish, but it's just helpful to kind of highlight the difference. So in certain Amish communities, it's not permitted to take on insurance. To procure insurance is seen as an act of a kind of aggression against the community. And the reason is that you withdraw yourself from the shared responsibility, that when some catastrophe or some bad event happens to someone in your community, you are personally obligated as a member of that community to help those people. So if someone's house burns down, you are personally obligated to go and help rebuild that house. Or if a parent dies, the community is responsible for helping to raise that family and to help financially with that family. What we do in sort of modern liberal society is to create an insurance market that we can all contribute to, And if something bad happens, we can make a claim on, but that claim is not on any particular individual. It's rather a depersonalized mechanism that liberates us from any particular obligation to any other person. You could say this is, again, the ground condition of our liberty, is not to have those, is to minimize those kinds of personal obligations. And so notice how, for example, these debates take place in our society. When we were debating the healthcare policy in recent years, the debate is really about whether or not it should be a private, more private, provided through private means, or through more public means. Should it be a more state-based system or more of a market-based system? But notice how that's a debate over means and not really ultimately over ends.
I mean, presumably, right? Presumably it's over means. I'm skeptical that we're still in fact we're debating over means. I think that there may be some political expediency in that. I mean, there are still, you know, Ron Paul gave up the ghost a little bit, where he's just like, you know, you don't get it, you don't get it. You know, if you don't have that insurance, you die, as opposed to, I think there's an argument on the other side.
I mean, there's extremes. But I think that in the main, you have people who are arguing that the better way to insure people is through market mechanisms. Or the better way to insure people is through mechanisms of government. There's a lot of people in sort of the middle who want to say, you know, you need, you know, more of one or more of the other. But then you have people on kind of, you have Ron Paul who argue it should be all private. And then you have, you know, people on the left who argue it should be single, you know, single payer, should be essentially through the state. The implications of these various decisions are, of course, quite significant. But what I really want to just highlight, and just by using this example, is that
the insurance separates you from the commitment to contribute, because you don't need them to help you
That's really what I wanted to highlight. Yep.
And that is the severing that that liberalism does, is it has attacked a communitarian spirit.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you could say is that it ultimately acts as a kind of solvent against sort of, you could say, almost every form of relationship that we can think of. And you can talk about it in terms of community. You can talk about it in terms of family. You can talk about it in terms of religion. You can talk about it in terms of association. Even today, you can talk about it increasingly in terms of nation. And, you know, one of the interesting debates we're having today that really comes out of this is there any coherent idea of what a nation is? Is there any reason why there should be borders or boundaries where they're drawn? Or is that really just is that just ultimately arbitrary? And if a nation is really just a liberal, sort of an instantiation of the liberal philosophy, then in the end, there's probably no reason to think that borders and boundaries actually have any coherent reason to exist, because it's really an idea that can't be bounded. And so one of the debates that's really, of course, roiling us today is there something more to a nation other than simply the liberal idea that seems to define it?
All right. Well, so let's you talk about let's talk about that concept of the new aristocracy, because we have ostensibly escaped that sort of the destiny of birth on some level, but really we have recreated it in the guise of a meritocracy, but it's not really.
It's not a meritocracy.
Well, I mean, your concept of my projection a little bit, but we have replaced the aristocracy with just simply a different sort of way of determining the aristocracy.
Right. So here again, it's helpful for us to go all the way back to John Locke or figures from the founding era, and the argument was clearly that the old aristocracy needed to be displaced. It needed to be essentially eliminated. Its legitimacy to be thrown out, and you could say that one of the great success stories of liberalism has been really, I mean, almost the complete elimination of any idea that there's any claim by an aristocratic order to a kind of place in society because of a birthright, that we would regard such claims as preposterous on their face. I mean, we're sort of fascinated by this idea. I take it, you know, the kind of fascination with shows like The Crown and Downton Abbey are these residual fascinations with this different way of organizing society. But if someone came to us and claimed that they deserved, you know, some superior status because of their lineage, we would regard that as patent nonsense. So on the one hand, liberalism has been very successful at displacing this old aristocracy. But Locke is quite clear that what he wants to do is to reconceive society so that people particularly with abilities to perform economically, who are very adventurous, you could say, willing to take extensive risks and have the talent and ability to make those risks pay off. And it's not always going to pay off, but it's a kind of disposition. And we sort of know people who are more prone to take those kinds of risks and will often profit from those risks, that those people should be given the kind of context in which that kind of spirit can manifest itself. And he differentiates the world not between people of certain birth and people of a lower birth, but he differentiates people between what he calls rational and industrious and quarrelsome and contentious, which is sort of people who work hard and people who complain about people who get more because they work hard. It's kind of a definition I guess Rush Limbaugh would love or something. But in effect, what Locke is arguing is for the opportunity in some ways to reshape society so that a kind of new ruling class can emerge, and in particular a ruling class that is able to accumulate more property. And you could say, again, that this has been a very successful project. Not only has the old aristocracy been displaced, but we have now recreated society so that those who can accumulate wealth have, you know, positions of considerable influence in our society, not just political, of course, but also culturally, that they run the major institutions in our society today, the media, the universities, the NGOs, and so forth, and that they have an outsized voice in our politics today. And again, if you want to look at where many of our contemporary political conflicts are arising from, it's the increasing sense that this new aristocracy may be as problematic and potentially as illegitimate as the old aristocracy seemed to someone like John Locke all those years ago.
Right. And I guess my sense is just that we're sold the idea that that's a meritocracy, but, you know, it just so happens that it's reflective of the person who gets to set the ground rules of what constitutes merit on day one, which will ultimately determine, you know, who gets those rewards. If I was in charge of the meritocracy, people who could do a podcast would be ruling our society right now.
Well, but yeah, but, you know, this is the ground conditions have been set, you know, for some several hundred years.
Right.
And this is what I'm saying is the liberal order itself. So yeah, it's in some ways it's arbitrary. It's maybe it's as arbitrary as, you know, if you were born to this duke or that earl or that prince. And in that sense, it's arbitrary. But on the other hand, you could say that we regard it as natural. We tend to regard those who are able to excel in certain kinds of aspects of their lives, particularly economic, as well as kind of the intellectual work that increasingly constitutes our economy, that those are the kind of ruling class. But you know, there is one element that we really do have to stress, and I think that you're suggesting as well, which is that increasingly the meritocracy, this new aristocracy, is able to perpetuate itself by birth. So it's become, interestingly, a kind of a new form of an old aristocracy. That is, you know, that's to say, the children of the people who are quite successful economically in our societies today are more or less insured far greater access and ultimately the far greater likelihood of success through the institutions that now sort of sift the economic winners from the economic losers. And you know, I've taught it. Some of the best universities in America, Notre Dame, Princeton, Georgetown, and it's quite evident that the kind of grooming that you need and the preparation that you need is not all that different in certain respects from the kind of grooming that you would have had as an aristocrat of old.
So, all right, so with this critique, I think, laid out sufficiently, like what... what could have been the alternative and what could be the alternative?
Well, I have many friends of a very conservative, even traditionalist disposition who would like us to go back to the Middle Ages and reconstitute some kind of old aristocracy and monarchy and integration of church and state and so forth. And I'm not counted among those. I would not count myself among those. I think it's necessary, of course, to recognize that this has been a phase in human history. This liberal political order and liberal society has been a phase in the history of the world. Francis Fukuyama in 1989 wrote that he believed that this was the end of history, that the question of political regime had been permanently settled and that there was no other option out there. I tend not to be of the view that the human let's say the human capacity to find new ways of organizing ourselves has exhausted itself. But on the other hand, I also want to be modest and suggest that anything that may follow liberalism is going to be a kind of a similar process of thinking through and experimenting with different forms. Just as liberalism didn't just kind of arise overnight. I mean, it was theorized 500 years ago, but it didn't arise overnight, and it took a long time to kind of develop. So I think that in many ways, going forward, we build on many of the achievements of liberalism, and I would not be someone to deny those. I mean, I have colleagues and friends who would want to deny those, but I think there are significant achievements. But at the same time, I think that what we can also see, or what I hope I persuade people of in this book, is that taken to its own extreme, it becomes a self-contradictory and ultimately a self-undermining kind of system, both politically and, I would say, more broadly, socially, economically, and so forth. And so I think right now we really are at the beginning stages of what I think will be a long process of rethinking this political, social, and economic order. And I don't want to say in advance what I think that will look like, but I do want to suggest that one thing that we want to think hard about is whether or not this this assumption of, I would call it an anthropological assumption, the assumption of human nature, the idea that we are by nature free, autonomous individuals who only achieve liberty through a kind of dissipation and a kind of reduction of all kinds of interpersonal obligations, that this is something that has to be fundamentally rethought. And when you suggest that, well, what we need is to begin to cultivate more practices and more forms of interpersonal obligation that are not just theoretical, it's not just through the state or it's not just through the market, but they're actually more local in both political, economic, and social senses. So local markets, I'm actually a big fan of local markets. I'm a big fan of local politics, and I'm a big fan of more local forms of associational life. But people, when they tend to hear that, they get kind of nervous, and they say, isn't that the source of all the oppression and injustice in the world? And what I want to say is that maybe there's a way in which a post-liberal world that's more local and communitarian can be one that can be not jettison the concerns for inclusivity and justice and equality, while at the same time embracing and valuing those kinds of interpersonal relationships that it seems to me that liberalism has been so successful at dissipating.
Can you be just a little bit more concrete with what that criticism is? Because, I mean, I think... drill down just a little bit, because the idea being that, I mean, look, there's reasons why some people leave their small town because they're not accepted there. And there's reasons why people leave their families because their families don't approve of their sexuality. There's the reasons why people leave a community because they're not welcome there because they're of a different race. I mean, is that when you talk about some people hear your suggestion just to be more localized, they say that has been a recipe for oppression in the past. Is that what they're talking about?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the one of the first reactions that one will typically get is, well, isn't that the source of all of this, these very old and ancient forms of oppression and limitation? And I guess what I want to say is that, to the extent that that's the case, and lamentably the case, again, in a context of having lived and experienced a liberal society, it seems to me that any claim that this is an effort to go back or to reconstruct something, that should be rejected out of hand. But at the same time, what I would ask and what I'm trying to urge is that we also see what's positive about those aspects of life. And my go-to philosopher in this regard is Alexis de Tocqueville, who had, it seems to me, extremely powerful contributions to make about where the vitality and robustness of American democracy arose was not ultimately from abstract forms of relationships in a kind of national system, but from the interpersonal relationships that arose from these more kinds of local contexts. And yes, you know, yes, these can be places where there can be injustice and even oppression, but these can be also places where one can in some ways be recognized, have one's voice heard, in some ways exercise the muscles of citizenship and of responsible citizenship in ways that I think have increasingly atrophied in our society today.
Why wouldn't, and maybe it would, but why wouldn't, let's say, socialism provide at least a context for those things to happen? Like, I can understand why you would argue, single payer does not fulfill that bill, even because it's too abstract. The idea that we all pay taxes and that's the way that we get health insurance is not as interpersonal. But something like, statutes that make a unionization, that encourage unionization more, would actually bring people together. Or things like statutory relief, like family leave or mandatory 4-day work weeks, so that people have that, you know, 3 days a weekend to sort of sit at home and be closer to their family or closer or more time to invest in their local community without having the obligation to make money to pay the rent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that if a lot of these public policy debates were framed in terms in which we might actually raise these kinds of concerns to the fore, I would be genuinely extremely enthusiastic. I mean, too often it seems like our policy debates really do tend to redound again to these questions of either the claim of the individual, this market ideology individual, or the needs of the state. And I'm not an anti-statist, even if I come across sounding like one. I'm actually I'm in favor of the idea of the common good. But too often when we talk about the state, it's that the state is seen as an engine of sort of ensuring our individual autonomy and our freedom from each other. And if that's what we think of the concept of the state is, then it seems to me it's just a different form of market ideology, or it's just a different means of attaining the same end, the same kind of individuated self. Now, the problem with socialism, and again, what are we talking about here? This is another concept we'd have to think
right
through, is that not only is it just kind of, again, this kind of impersonal mechanism, but it also it treats in some ways the kind of this sense of obligation to others in such a kind of sort of a dissipated and abstract form that I think it actually exists in some ways to liberate us from the sense of having any actual obligations to others. Now, that said, I think it's worth thinking about the ways that the power of the state could be used to increase the ways that we can have an increased forms of interpersonal relationships and obligations to each other. And this may mean, for example, in certain ways, restraining some of the market ideology in our society. And I'm not opposed to the idea of the state being involved in some of those areas. So, for example, you mentioned 4-day work weeks. I mean, I don't know what the perfect, I'm not an economist, I don't know what the perfect length of the work week is and what the implications of that would be. But the idea, for example, of constraining the size of, or let's say the kind of monopolistic tendencies of capitalism, right, which we're certainly seeing today, certainly in the tech world, and increasing the likelihood that we have a society in which ownership is more widespread. This might sound to some people as socialist, but it's really an increase of property ownership. And one of our problems today isn't so much that it's capitalist, it's that too few people have capital, or too few people own property. And so it seems to me that one of the classic ways of understanding the appropriate role of the state is to restrain the tendencies of markets to accumulate too much, for individual actors in markets to accumulate too much power and to pool too much capital in too few places. And what's interesting today, it seems to me that the left and the right have abandoned that particular concern.
On the left, I mean, we've certainly over the past year and a half, there's been a growing sort of, you know, antitrust movement in the left. I mean, I think that's, you know,
it hasn't made its way to Washington yet, or at least I haven't seen it. But if so, I'm very happy to hear that.
I would push back on that a little bit. I mean, you can see it in the Gorsuch hearings when you're talking about sort of the big guy over the little guy. You can see a lot of Elizabeth Warren. There was that big open markets brouhaha with Google and all those folks having left. It's still pretty nascent, and maybe you need to, in my meritocracy, people like I who was aware of that would be rewarded again with everything. But it may be, you know, certainly not that large. But that is a burgeoning, I think, movement on the left, and I think we may see more of that in the wake of Facebook.
I think there might be some interesting pockets on the right where you would actually find some sympathy as well. So maybe this is one area where the idea of increasing an ownership society might be a potential bridge between these kinds of political divides, and precisely in a way that seeks to foster a kind of, you know, a more widespread sense of societal and economic responsibility and reward that everyone can share in. This seems to me to be something that both a kind of market ideology and a statist ideology tend to decrease, but where the power of the state can be used to increase the possibility and the plausibility of these more kind of interpersonal ties and communal ties to increase, then I think it's a genuinely a good and just use of state power.
When you say increase the ownership society, are you saying basically spread the wealth? I mean, it's interesting because I think like what's interesting is that your book has been received in pockets on the right and pockets on the left with equal enthusiasm, I think, and that's interesting. And I'm just curious. I mean, is that why do you think that is?
Well, I think. In the first place, I think it's fair to say it's been received with equal enthusiasm as well as equal criticism. So that where I tend to be critical of the market and market ideology, the left finds resonance, and where I tend to be critical of both the kind of form of statism as well as the left's pursuit of individualism, particularly through the sexual revolution, I tend to have support on the right. The problem is that people tend to look and they find the parts that they like without seeing what I hope is, which is that the deeper continuities between the left and the right today. And I would say it's a much smaller pocket of people who actually have read it and said, "Wow, this really has changed the way that I see our entire politics." But I'm encouraged that there are those people who are beginning to see that. And so when I say that I would like to see a greater ownership society, well, in the first place, yes, I think seeing the development of an anti-monopolistic set of public priorities would be highly desirable, but also with the accompanying effort to say, what can we do through our public policy to make it more likely that people can own productive property or run productive kinds of businesses that are not gigantic conglomerates that, in fact, give people a stake in society. And I think one of my problems with the idea of socialism, ultimately, is that it says people get something, but they don't necessarily see how they're contributing to the thing that they're getting. As we know, from living in a dormitory, for example, if it's not yours, people tend not to take good care of it. So a society in which you have more ownership of property, including productive property through business or small kinds of stores, or back in the old days, and maybe once again through the ownership of farms, that it increases the sense of people having a stake, and I think as a result, the sense that citizenship and being a part of this this broader community has that everyone is in some ways invested in this together.
Well, we certainly have support for co-ops around here, mm-hmm. Worker-owned co-ops. But it's a fascinating read. Patrick Denine, author of Why Liberalism Failed. I appreciate you coming on and talking about it.
Thanks. It's been a terrific discussion. Thank you.